In the last lecture, I tried to offer some ideas on working toward rationality in polarized contexts. This lecture focuses on something characteristic of polarized contexts, rhetoric. In this lecture, I want to talk about rhetoric versus rationality. Rhetoric has acquired a bad name. It's hard to say rhetoric without empty or mere in front of it, mere rhetoric. But that wasn't always the case. Let me start with a little history. At one time, rhetoric was highly respected as a required skill for effective speaking and presentation of ideas. Plato has a dialogue on the theme, the Gorgias, named after a prominent teacher of rhetoric. Aristotle has a major work on the topic, Aristotle's Rhetoric. The Roman orator Cicero was famous as a teacher of rhetoric. In her biography of Cleopatra, Stacy Schiff argues that Cleopatra's success was due far more to her skill in rhetoric than her supposed beauty. Classical education throughout the Middle Ages was based on the trivium, consisting of grammar, logic, and rhetoric. Those were the foundations of a liberal education, the areas everyone was expected to master. But the dark side of rhetoric also became clear early on. It's a theme in Plato's Gorgias. There, Plato has Socrates argue that rhetoric involves no real knowledge or sense of justice, that rhetoric alone, unalloyed with philosophy, is merely a form of deceptive advertising or flattery. One has to remember that at that time, the rhetoricians were, in a sense, philosophy's competitors. Plato's anti-rhetoric dialogue is also remarkable for its effectiveness, that is, for the effectiveness of its rhetoric. In his work on the topic, Aristotle admits that rhetorical skills can be used for either good or bad. His task is to analyze persuasion. What is it that makes a presentation effective? That's still a good question. Even contemporary attempts to answer it would do well to start with Aristotle, and often do. What makes a presentation effective? Three things. The persuasiveness of a presentation depends, first of all, on the character of the speaker. We are convinced by people we see as knowledgeable and wise, as effective leaders who are in the right. Aristotle calls that ethos. Second, the persuasiveness of a presentation depends on the emotions of the hearer. A message that resonates emotionally is one that's going to be more effective. Aristotle calls that pathos. Third, persuasiveness depends on the logic of the argument. Do you want to persuade? Lay out the argument clearly and rationally, step by step. That's logos. When I think of rhetoric, I think of Mark Antony's, "Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears." But of course, that's not a quote from Mark Antony himself. It comes from Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. Education in Elizabethan England was saturated with the classics, even elementary education. Shakespeare is reputed to have studied at the King's Free Grammar School in Stratford. No records remain, so we don't know for sure. Might Shakespeare have read Aristotle's rhetoric? All we have is speculation. In support of that speculation, however, are the two prominent speeches at Caesar's funeral in Shakespeare's play. The first speech is by Brutus, one of the assassins. "Hear me for my cause and be silent, that you may hear. Believe me for mine honor and have respect to mine honor." That looks like an attempt to establish character, Aristotle's ethos. The Shakespearean scholars Charles and Michelle Martindale further characterize Brutus's speech in terms of logos as a style for the intellect. If someone asks why Brutus rose against Caesar, this is my answer, not that I loved Caesar less, but that I loved Rome more. Mark Antony gives a speech in response to Brutus's, and it's very different. Ironic and indirect, where Brutus's is explicit and direct. Mark Antony undercuts Brutus's built-up ethos with a mockingly repeated phrase. Brutus says that Caesar was ambitious, and Brutus is an honorable man. When that the poor have cried, Caesar hath wept. Ambition should be made of sterner stuff. Yet Brutus says he was ambitious, and Brutus is an honorable man. I thrice presented him a kingly crown, which he did thrice refuse. Was this ambition? Yet Brutus says he was ambitious, and Brutus is an honorable man. As the Martindales note, the currency of Antony's speech is not logic, but emotion, pathos. Quote, if you have tears, prepare to shed them now. Look, in this place ran Cassius's dagger through. See what a rent the envious Casca made. Through this, the well-beloved Brutus stabbed, the most unkindest cut of all. So what do you think? Is that evidence that Shakespeare knew Aristotle's rhetoric? What of Abraham Lincoln? My colleague at Stony Brook, the political scientist Frank Myers, points out that all three elements of Aristotle's rhetoric are artfully managed in Lincoln's famous Cooper Union speech. Lincoln and Stephen Douglas were rival candidates for the Senate from Illinois and held debates across the state. Parts of those debates gained national attention in the newspapers. Lincoln lost the election for senator, but shortly afterward was invited to speak at the Cooper Union in New York. Lincoln's law partner, William Herndon, said that no former speech writing had cost Lincoln so much time and thought. Here's what an eyewitness said. When Lincoln rose to speak, I was greatly disappointed. He was tall, oh, how tall, and so angular and awkward that I had for an instant a feeling of pity for so ungainly a man. Add to that the fact that Lincoln spoke not in the deep, resonant voice we remember from so many portrayals, but in a high-pitched accent blending frontier Indiana and Kentucky. The question of the day was whether the federal government had the right to control the expansion of slavery into the Western territories. With no flowery introduction, Lincoln takes on the question in terms of the Constitution. He gives a detailed and scholarly examination of the relevant views and related actions of each of the 39 delegates who signed it. Despite his appearance, despite his frontier accent, Lincoln uses that first part of the speech to establish himself as knowledgeable and indeed scholarly with regard to the questions at issue. That same eyewitness who was disappointed on first impression says that once Lincoln started speaking, his face lighted up as with an inward fire. The whole man was transfigured. I forgot his clothes, his personal appearance, and his individual peculiarities. Presently, forgetting myself, I was cheering this wonderful man. Lincoln has established that first element of Aristotle's rhetoric, the impression of character. The third element of Aristotle's rhetoric is the logic of the argument. That, too, Lincoln worked on long and hard. His law partner Herndon says rightly that the speech was constructed with a view to accuracy of statement, simplicity of language, and unity of thought. In some respects, like a lawyer's brief, it was logical and temperate in tone. Aristotle's three modes of persuasion are character, logic, and emotion. But emotion only appears in the very last part of Lincoln's speech. Had he started with an emotional appeal, it's likely people would have seen only a ranter from the wilderness. What he needed first were character and logic. He saves emotion for the conclusion. Neither let us be slandered from our duty by false accusations against us, nor frightened from it by menaces of destruction to the government, nor of dungeons to ourselves. Let us have faith that right makes might, and in that faith let us to the end dare to do our duty as we understand it. There are similar analyses of Lincoln's Gettysburg Address in terms of Aristotle's rhetoric. So why did rhetoric get a bad name? Perhaps because one element of Aristotle's three can be faked. Ethos, the aspect of character. You'll be just as persuasive if you can make yourself appear knowledgeable as you will if you really are. No need to really know what you're talking about, just look the part. Another element of Aristotle's three is prime territory for manipulation, pathos. Appeal to emotion is so clearly an element beyond the rational that it appears on the list of standard fallacies. Is emotion itself wrong? No. Indeed, we've seen how important it is. But when an appeal to reason is replaced by something intended merely to push our emotional buttons, it's not rational persuasion, but emotional manipulation at work. Our contemporary and negative sense of rhetoric is firmly in place in the work of the 19th century philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer. Schopenhauer's major work was The World as Will and Representation. Cited as a major influence on Nietzsche, Wittgenstein, Freud, Einstein, and, unfortunately, on Adolf Hitler. Schopenhauer was also the author of The Art of Controversy, a user's guide to rhetoric in the contemporary negative sense. He characterizes the topic as intellectual fencing, used for the purpose of getting the best of a dispute, period. He admits it has nothing to do with truth. Thrust and parry is the whole business. Chapter 3 of Schopenhauer's book is titled Stratagems. It's a list of 38 rhetorical tricks. It might as well be called How to Win an Argument by Any Means Possible. Schopenhauer's irony is evident. Some of the tricks explicitly manipulate emotion. Make your opponent angry, Schopenhauer says. He won't think straight. How should you do that? By doing him repeated injustice or practicing some kind of chicanery and being generally insolent. If he does become angry, Schopenhauer says, you should press your case with even more zeal. Irritate him by contradiction and contention until he exaggerates his original statement. Even though what your opponent originally said was right, hone in on the exaggeration. But when you refute this exaggerated form, you look as though you had also refuted his original statement, says Schopenhauer. If it looks like your opponent is getting the upper hand, become personal, insulting, and rude. That's the rhetoric we're more familiar with, the kind of rhetoric we're all too familiar with. In the last lecture, we talked about how to strive for rationality in a polarized context. There, a major strategy was to try to lift the dispute out of rhetoric, to remove it from Schopenhauer's intellectual fencing debate context, to go to the balcony, looking at the issue at a distance removed from ego involvement and emotion. But what is one to do when that's not possible? The best defense is to know the enemy and see it coming. But by enemy, I don't mean the other side. The enemy is rhetoric. One can guard against rhetoric by getting to know it, even by getting good at it. The best defense against mere rhetoric is to know its tactics well enough to call them by name and parry them when they come. Appeal to emotion is one of those tactics. Emotion itself isn't bad. Life and even rationality would be impossible without it. But there are points at which something more is required. Careful weighing of alternatives, consideration of evidence, tracking potential consequences, and after due consideration, making a decision. Appeal to emotion is intended to cross-circuit all that, pushing your buttons instead of appealing to your reason. Watch out for it. Appeal to emotion is often by means of emotionally loaded words. There are lots of ways to say something. Consider, Bill came home late, as opposed to Bill snuck into the house long after he was due. The basic facts may be the same. The portrayal is not, precisely because of the emotional language in that second case. Consider Jones won the election, as opposed to, against all odds, Jones finally triumphed over the status quo. The difference is all those emotionally loaded words. So when you hear something like this, fanatics on the religious right have wormed their way into the most powerful and privileged positions of the Republican Party. Now they're really going to start shoving things down our throats. Figure out what it really says when it's drained of the rhetorical phrases that are a mere appeal to emotion. There are other classic fallacies that appear on Schopenhauer's list of rhetorical tricks. The stratagem known as straw man fallacy appears in a number of forms. Schopenhauer recommends exaggerating the claims made on the other side. That will, of course, make them easier to refute. He recommends twisting the words used on the other side so that they mean something different than intended. Ignore your opponent's real position. Confuse the issue by imputing something different. The fallacy is called straw man because you're no longer arguing against the opponent's real position. It's as if you can't beat Billy in a fair fight, so you go home and take it out on a dummy made of straw. Take that, Billy, you say, effectively demolishing not the real Billy, just the straw man. We'll cover other fallacies in later lectures. Ad hominem, appeal to authority, and diversion, those appear on Schopenhauer's list as well. Among Schopenhauer's recommendations is a standard debating trick. Shift the burden of proof to the opponent. One way is simply to say, "This is my position. Go ahead, prove me wrong." That, of course, relieves you of the burden of proving yourself right. It's your opponent who's on the spot. But, of course, the fact that he may not be able to prove you wrong doesn't really prove that you're right. Schopenhauer also recommends that you lump the opponent's position into some odious category. That's fascism, you can say. Or, that's socialism. Don't bother to explain why the view is fascism, or even what fascism is. The emotionally loaded category is meant to do all the work by itself, and it often does. If all else fails, Schopenhauer says, bluff. Or throw so many unrelated charges that your opponent doesn't have a chance to respond to them all. Or bewilder him with mere bombast. Or become personal, insulting, and rude. Schopenhauer's rhetorical recommendations are ironic, of course. He didn't want to be a victim of bombast any more than we do. But look at how far rhetoric in that sense is from what Aristotle meant. Look at how far rhetoric in that sense is from the presentational dynamics of Lincoln's Cooper Union address. Unfortunately, it's not so far from what we've become accustomed to in political argument. Rhetorical tricks may be particularly characteristic of political argument in contemporary media. What would the Cooper Union address look like today, as reported by any of the major broadcast media? There are cases in which a full speech by a candidate becomes part of the media stream. Barack Obama's speech on race in the midst of the 2008 campaign is an example. But most contemporary political media consists of sound clips extracted from some larger speech or 30-second political commercials. Those are contexts made for rhetoric. Logos and ethos don't have time to do their work in a soundbite, but pathos does. It only takes a split second for an appeal to emotion to do its dirty work. Rhetoric, in the sense of Schopenhauer's tricks, was made for the intellectual fencing characteristic of debate in sound bites. I've said that it's important to develop an appreciation for rhetorical tricks. I'm not advocating that you employ them to win your next argument. I urge you to learn them as a means of intellectual self-defense. Knowing the tricks will help you guard against being on the receiving end of those tricks. There's another lesson here regarding the ethics of argument. If you're like me, you find rhetorical tricks intellectually repulsive. Schopenhauer's list has all the charm of a wax museum arcade of famous murderers. These are tips on how to win arguments, or at least on how to appear to win. These are tips for one-upmanship in the fencing matches of debates. But the serious question isn't how to win arguments. The real question is when to win arguments, or even whether to win arguments. The real question is whether winning is what we're after all. Schopenhauer says that the intellectual fencing he's talking about has nothing to do with truth, and that's precisely the problem. By my lights, rational discussion, like rational argument, should be about the truth. A truth that may include the truth about people's rights, about best available policy, or about reasonable accommodation between different interests. We want to work toward the truth by means of rational argument. Reasoning with others, like reasoning with ourselves, comes with a built-in goal to work toward the truth. Persuasion alone isn't a worthy goal. That's mere rhetoric. Let's return to rhetoric on the positive side. What study of rhetoric emphasizes is that rationality isn't an exclusively individual undertaking. Rationality is something that we can and should practice together. Rational discussion is just that, discussion. Discussion is a social endeavor, and rationality may actually demand a social dynamics. What rhetoric emphasizes, at its best, not its worst, is the social dynamics of intellectual exchange. Often it's only when we see ideas in a context of discussion, or even civil debate, that we can see them most clearly. That's certainly the theory in criminal law and in high-cost civil suits. The adversarial system is based on the conviction that it's from the clash of arguments in which each side presents its best case, subject to cross-examination, that the truth will out. Does the truth always out in adversarial proceedings? I don't know anyone who thinks so. We all know that a case may be carried by lawyers' rhetorical tricks, appeal to emotion on the part of the jury, for example, rather than by the force of evidence and argument. But I don't know anyone who thinks we should replace that system with a single inquisitor, doing all the investigating by himself, asking all the questions, and then serving as both judge and jury. The consensus seems to be that there is at least a better chance that the truth will out when we have arguments and evidence laid out on opposing sides, with a final verdict left to the collective deliberations of the jury. In Lecture 9, we used flow diagrams to graph the logical flow of an argument. In that context, we were talking about an argument as a one-sided affair. We were trying to graph the logical flow from a set of propositions offered as reasons to the conclusion they were meant to support. Are they working independently, or as a set of dependent reasons that have to work together? In the last part of that lecture, we expanded the technique to two types of reasons, data and warrant, based on the work of the 20th century philosopher Stephen Tolman. The idea is that a premise may be giving you an evidential base, a piece of information or data, or it may be giving you the warrant that allows you to draw a particular conclusion from that data. Tolman's larger project was to reintroduce, rehabilitate, and modernize the study of rhetoric as a study of argument in the sense of discourse, the exchange of ideas between two or more interlocutors. He was out to reintroduce, rehabilitate, and modernize the study of rhetoric. Let's expand our earlier visualization, then, in order to see how one can graph an argument on both sides of an issue. We'll use a simple exchange between two people.
So I figured out what's wrong with the washing machine. The belt is broken.
What makes you think that?
You can hear the motor running, but nothing else turns.
And that makes you think it's the belt?
Well, that would explain it. If the belt was broken, the motor can turn all at once, but nothing else will.
But maybe it's something jammed in the main drum. The motor would work then, but the drum wouldn't turn even if there wasn't any problem with the belt.
I guess so, but that's pretty unlikely. Let's just say it's probably the belt.
Well, let's take a look.
You couldn't find a more normal exchange. Broken appliances. A delightful break from broken politics, anyway. Here's how we might construct a flow diagram of that little exchange. Mark makes the first claim we're interested in. The belt is broken. That's really his conclusion. We don't have his reasoning yet. Tessa draws that out. What makes you think that? He gives the data on which his conclusion is based. You can hear the motor running, but nothing turns. So at this point, we can do a diagram that goes from Mark's data to his conclusion. Look at the two pieces of his data, by the way. You can hear the motor running, nothing turns. Remember the distinction we made before. Are those working independently or dependently? They're working dependently. Mark is presenting them as two pieces of the puzzle which together lead him to believe that the belt's broken. Just hearing the motor running wouldn't tell him that. Nothing turns wouldn't be specific enough. Those are offered as pieces of evidence which together suggest a conclusion. But now Tessa asks, and what makes you think it's the belt? Note that she isn't asking a question about the data. She's asking a question about maybe even challenging, the inference from the data to the conclusion. She's really asking, do you think that data warrants the conclusion that the belt's broken? The warrant is what's supposed to carry us from the data to the conclusion. I'll write in Tess's question as a challenge at that point. We'll use blue for Mark's contributions, yellow indicate Tess's. Mark answers the challenge by providing a warrant. Well, that would explain it. He offers further backing by spelling out the explanation. If the belt's broken, the motor can turn all it wants, but nothing else will. At this point, Tess offers a counter-hypothesis. Maybe it's something jammed in the main drum. Note that she doesn't deny the data Mark offered. In fact, she's going to use that data with a different warrant for the opposing conclusion. I'll change Mark's original data to a different color to indicate that both people are now using it. Tessa uses the same data toward an alternative conclusion, though a qualified conclusion. Maybe it's something jammed in the main drum. Her warrant is an alternative explanation, spelled out with further backing. If something is jammed, the motor would work, but the drum wouldn't turn, even if there is no problem with the belt. Note that Tess's is now a structure parallel to Mark's. She too uses the data as dependent premises, but her warrant is an alternative that would explain it, with a different backing. Note that I've also marked her maybe as a qualification on her conclusion. Maybe something is jammed in the main drum. Mark ends by conceding that Tessa has an alternative explanation backing an alternative hypothesis. I guess so. He introduces a challenge to Tessa's explanation. It's pretty unlikely. But at the same time, he adds a qualification to his own claim. Let's just say it's probably the belt. What we've graphed is not just an argument on one side, but the exchange of arguments on both sides. Luckily, Mark and Tessa have listened to the previous lecture on how to work rationally within a polarized context. Tessa suggests that they put the matter to an objective test. Let's take a look. There's nothing magic about the way I've sketched the logic of the discussion. Where the pattern of an argument is really important, I urge you to try sketching it out as a graph, with whatever conventions seem most useful to you. When I expect a philosophical discussion to become complex, I sometimes sketch it out in advance. I include not only exchanges I've heard, but possible exchanges to come. Graphs with branches for different possibilities. Perhaps he'll use this argument. Perhaps she'll make this reply. In that case, my best response is probably this one. In that kind of case, I'll be trying to muster the best argument that can be made on one side, but it's still Aristotle's logos that I'll be trying to use. I'm not plotting rhetorical tricks. I'm trying to map out the alleys we can expect to explore in search of the truth. The analysis of a rational discussion differs from that of a single argument in that there will be more than just premises and conclusions, more than even data warrant and conclusions. There will be challenges raised on one side, which will force qualifications on the other, and which may well evoke refinement of the argument and further backup in response. Complicated? Yes. And yet in normal discourse, we manage to follow the train of thought, the logical flow of argument, all the time. What graphic visualization allows is the possibility of seeing that logical flow. What we've done here is to expand our graphing tools into the social context of discourse. There are a number of points regarding rationality and rhetoric that I hope you'll take home from this lecture. What makes a presentation persuasive? Remember the three themes in Aristotle's rhetoric: character, emotion, and reasoning; ethos, pathos, and logos. Remember some of the dirty tricks on Schopenhauer's list, not in order to slaughter the opposition, but so that you can defend yourself against rhetoric's dark side. Try sketching out the flow of a discussion. Develop the ability to visualize the pattern of an exchange by starting with short and simple examples. I also hope you'll remember that argument comes with an ethics. The best that mere rhetoric could offer is mere winning. Truth and genuine rationality demand a far higher standard than that.